This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. The government giveth, the government taketh away, right? Empty pension promises. Why you need to be paying attention to the economic precedents being established in this Detroit bankruptcy. Also, we'll have a story of banks buying up aluminum as a hedge against paper. That's coming right up. Later this hour, we'll look at how Netflix is changing entertainment and the entertainment business. Our caregiver series continues. We'll continue to hear from you caregivers out there. But first, you're retired and your only income is a pension. The institution paying the pension goes bankrupt. You do the math. Retired Detroit firefighter Brendan Milewski is doing the math, and he's not happy about it.
I was an active employee of the fire department in Detroit for 12 years. I was in an accident. As a result, I'm a paraplegic. There's rumor of the benefit being reduced. It's caused me and my wife to sit down with a calculator and look at our monthly budget, where we're staring at a very dramatic impact.
Doing the math in Detroit, the city will plead its case on pension obligations and a reported $3.5 billion shortfall before a federal bankruptcy court, with pensioners apparently standing in line along with other creditors. Here to explain how all that works is Wayne State University Professor of Law, Peter Henning. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about the bankruptcy question and the category of people in a pension program, which, depending on where you are in the pension program, there's a different level of protection, a different level of fear, I suppose. There are people who are in a pension program. There are people who are actually vested and in a pension program that maybe began some years ago. And then there are people who are actually receiving benefits who are retired. How do bankruptcy courts look at these three categories?
Well, certainly the category that's at greatest risk are those who have already retired and are drawing their benefits. And especially in Detroit, and this is true in a number of cities, some of those workers were not part of the Social Security system. So their city pension is the only support that they have. That is, I think, the largest category. It's about 20,000. Then you also have current city workers, those who vested or those who haven't vested yet. But in the bankruptcy process, they're all going to be what are called unsecured creditors, unless, of course, this issue of the Michigan Constitution somehow affects the analysis. But generally, retirees and those who are participating in a pension program are considered unsecured creditors, which is those are the people who are often in the weakest position in any type of bankruptcy restructuring.
Does the Michigan Constitution protect retirees in any concrete way that the courts have affirmed?
Well, this is where it gets very complicated. The Michigan Constitution says essentially that pensions for government workers, state and local, can't be tampered with, that you can't change the benefits, you can't diminish the benefits. That's a matter of state law, state constitutional law. The problem is that bankruptcy is a matter of federal law. And when you are in a federal bankruptcy court, it's that court's rules that apply. And the bankruptcy code deals with secured and unsecured creditors in different ways. But it's not clear, and this is going to be a very important issue that has to be decided, what impact, if any, does the Michigan constitutional protection, what impact does that have on the bankruptcy process? Normally, a bankruptcy judge could cut down on what an unsecured creditor receives, but does the Michigan Constitution protect those workers? That's going to be one of the first questions. And, of course, it's already a major fight in both the state and federal bankruptcy court.
And at the very least, whatever happens here in this Detroit bankruptcy will set a lot of precedents around the nation if we get into other sorts of federal, state, fiscal crises that result in these kinds of bankruptcy resolutions. Just so people don't think this is only about Detroit, the question of pensions and pension promises turning out to be maybe less than advertised is something that's been working through the private sector for quite some time. Airline industry, we saw it 4 years ago in the auto industry bailout, the question of who's a creditor and whether pensioners or bondholders have greater standing. Can you sketch out the difference between how the private sector has dealt with pensions, the guarantees that are available, and what's available for the public sector employees?
Well, certainly the key difference is that in the private sector, you do have, at least for the what are called the defined benefit pension plans, where you get a percentage of your salary, you do have the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which provides something of a safety net, some insurance. Now, you won't get the full amount of your promised pension, but you do have that protection. That agency does not insure government pensions. And so the thought had always been that, of course, the government pension was much more secure because of the power to tax, that if the government needed to, it would simply raise taxes. In Detroit, just to use that as the specific example, Detroit's at its limit as far as taxing, and that's not a very good option for any number of other state and local governments that are facing major shortfalls. So this issue of how do you deal with it, on the government side, it had often been, well, of course, we can rely on government. Government has good credit. Government's not going to default on this. Whether that promise turns out to be one that can be fulfilled is really the scary question in this Detroit bankruptcy, because if a bankruptcy court can step in and restructure pensions, in other words, reduce the benefits, then how much protection do those government workers have? And, of course, how much do the retirees have? Those are often the people without a voice in the political process.
Is bankruptcy in both the private and public sector a backdoor out of pension obligations and other benefit obligations that up front look secure, but on the back end, maybe not so much?
Well, certainly in the auto industry bankruptcies, the GM and Chrysler, you saw that one of the reasons for them declaring bankruptcy was because of the very heavy what are called legacy costs. And it's not just the pension. It's also the promise of continuing health care. And that, of course, can be a major drain on any company or any government. And so what we've seen in the private sector certainly is that bankruptcy, or even just the threat of bankruptcy, can be a way to restructure pensions, to change what will be owed, and to restructure those health care costs. It hasn't translated yet over to the public sector, to the public sector pensions, but that may really just be a function of the issue hasn't really come up yet. Now, it did before Detroit. There was Central Falls, Rhode Island had pension issues. It was a much smaller town, but it dealt with it by negotiating a reduction in the pensions that were paid. And so will this grow? Certainly there is that possibility because of the major shortfalls in pension funding in a number of state and local governments.
Well, the issue is certainly on the table now. Peter Henning, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Peter Henning is a law professor at Wayne State University Law School in Detroit. So, if pensions aren't worth the documents they're printed on, if the tax base of Detroit is exhausted and depleted of cash, if the auto industry's traditional worker protections have become a dream of the past, what has real value in Detroit, in the Detroit area? How about big boxes of aluminum bars, steel, platinum, wheat, soybeans, pork bellies, commodities of all kinds? Real stuff, real value, right? Well, not so fast. Our partner, the New York Times, has uncovered what looks like something of a legal shell game in the holding and trading of the commodity of aluminum. A shell game being played in the warehouses of the industrial Detroit suburb of Mount Clemens. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, among other big banks, have been buying up companies that store and deliver commodities. The banks can profit from holding commodities, but they can also raise the prices for consumers in the process, at least in theory. With us, before she testifies on the subject, before the Congressional Banking Committee, is Saleh Amarova. She's a professor of law at the University of North Carolina. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, John.
What's the difference between a bank playing the commodities market and actually owning commodities like aluminum?
Well, banks historically have gotten into the commodities markets, physical commodities markets, ostensibly because such presence would help them to price better their financial derivatives contracts that are linked to the prices of underlying commodities. So technically speaking, they don't have to own a warehouse and they don't have to own any physical commodities. But if they do, it gives them an upper hand in understanding the market, understanding the prices, and as you already mentioned, potentially even influencing those prices, perhaps in a way that helps them profit from their derivatives contracts whose price depends on those underlying commodity prices.
So why would a bank rather hold aluminum? Is it something to do with the dubious value of paper assets and paper derivatives? Is there something more secure about a big box full of aluminum?
I don't think it's about aluminum being more secure just because of its physical existence necessarily. I think what it is that these are private firms, they're profit-seeking firms. They would go wherever they see a profit. So once they were able to move into the business that actually gives them additional profits, be it through the rental income that end users of aluminum, for example, have to pay to the owner of the warehouse, be it through the fact that by controlling the delivery of the metal out of the warehouse, Goldman Sachs influences the prices for aluminum globally. And if Goldman Sachs also trades aluminum, then that rise in the prices may in fact benefit it. Or be it, like I said, the ability to take more profitable positions in the purely financial markets that are linked to the price of commodities. So the business strategies for making money off of holding physical aluminum may be varied. And it would be a mistake to just basically pin down one reason. I think we need to understand all of the reasons for Goldman Sachs to get into this business.
Is the net effect here, though, whether we call it manipulation or not, that if banks are making a lot of profit being in the commodities business, that prices are going to go up for consumers, particularly for aluminum, which is an industrial commodity that really tracks the price of all kinds of consumer goods?
That's absolutely true. And in fact, I understand that prices have gone up. Whether or not we feel it, whether or not we notice it, it's a separate matter. The fact is that these prices should not go up simply because of the market structure. Supply and demand is one thing, but when prices are artificially inflated because a particular actor has a particular reason to hoard the metal effectively, that is a matter of serious concern.
Senators and members of Congress are going to be asking you whether this is a good idea or not when you testify today. What are you going to tell them?
What I'm going to tell them that we should put the burden squarely on the banks themselves to prove to us that it is, in fact, a good idea. They always tell us that they only get into the physical commodities business in order to serve their clients better and to produce public benefits. But somehow, we still don't know whether or not it's true. And what I'm going to tell Congress today, if they listen to me, is that this is a time to put them on the spot and make them actually sustain the burden of proving their claims.
Sally Almarova is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina. She'll be testifying before the Senate Banking Committee later on today. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Here's a caregiver story. In 1993, this summer when I was 12, my grandmother had eye surgery. I stayed with her, cooked her dinner, did her laundry, read her the Bible every night for a couple of months. Despite how that sounds to most 12-year-olds and losing most of my summer, it was pretty awesome. She told me all sorts of stories from when she was a kid, like tipping cows and being a nurse in World War II. She passed away a few years ago, and I really miss her. That listener caregiver from Tulsa, Oklahoma. Reach us with your story at the hashtag #ICareFor or call us at 877-8MYTAKE. We continue our week-long series on caregivers in America later this hour. Stay with us. So what would the cost of intervention in the civil war in Syria be? The dollar cost. You'll remember Pentagon officials in describing the cost of the war in Iraq in the lead up to 2003 suggested it might pay for itself. That isn't exactly how it worked out, of course. And perhaps as a warning for policymakers eager to do something to stop the carnage in Syria, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, has sent a letter to the Senate Armed Services Committee. It details five possible military courses of action, including training, advising, and assisting rebel fighters, establishing a no-fly zone, conducting limited standoff strikes in Syria, creating buffer zones to protect certain areas of the country, and taking control of Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons stockpile. General Dempsey gives a dollar estimate to each course of action, and there is no suggestion that this might be done on the cheap or in a short period of time. Joining us now is Colonel Peter Mansour, professor of military history at Ohio State University, former executive officer for General David Petraeus, who spent 26 years in the U.S. Army. Peter Mansour, welcome back to the program.
Great to be back on, John.
So how costly is this as you look at General Dempsey's letter? And we're going to hear more about this over the next couple of days and weeks.
Well, the dollar costs range from $500 million for a train and assist effort, that's per year, to perhaps up to $1 billion a month for a more kinetic option, such as establishing a no-fly zone over Syria. But the more important costs are the human costs and the opportunity costs of what else we could be doing with our military in terms of re-energizing it after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have wound down.
Are the numbers here the reality, or is this a tonal shift in the Pentagon? I remember General Colin Powell saying, you break it, you buy it, referring to Iraq. This sounds more like it's already broken. If we're going to buy it, this is what it's going to cost. Look at these numbers. Very, very explicit, very, very sobering.
Again, the dollar cost figures are sobering, but even more sobering is the fact that if we get involved, we're likely to be involved for many, many years to come. This is a conflict that had we done something early on, we might have prevented a civil war from breaking out. But now that one is going full bore, it's going to take a long time to resolve. I think we've saw that in Bosnia, and we're seeing it in Iraq as well.
Is the real message from General Dempsey here, don't do this, stay away, wave it off?
I think his real message is not necessarily that. It's that if you think, if the administration thinks that this is an important enough national security goal to stabilize Syria in some manner, don't go in with your eyes closed thinking it's going to be cheap and easy. It's going to be hard, it's going to be long, and it's going to be expensive.
Now, I would have thought, and you have a lot of experience with General David Petraeus and the doctrine of counterinsurgency, I would have thought that given the unpopularity of Bashar al-Assad, the apparent enthusiasm that Syrian civilians have for some sort of international involvement in the civil war, that this would really be an opportunity for advancing counterinsurgency doctrine in Syria and making a real impact. Sounds like General Dempsey wants no part of it.
Well, Assad's only unpopular with a percentage of the population. It could be a majority, but it still is not everyone. His Alawite sect supports him, and certain other groups support him as well. So, and the great majority of the civilians, as in any counterinsurgency conflict, are waiting on the sideline, seeing who's going to prevail. And so this is not a clear-cut case where if you could just give him a shove, he'll fall from power, as was the case in, say, Libya with Gaddafi. This is much more serious. And I think a large counterinsurgency type effort, as we saw in Iraq or Afghanistan, is certainly not in the cards. What is more likely would be that we energize some part of the opposition to start an insurgency against Assad and try to topple him that way. But again, that could take years, if not decades.
You know, forgive me for trying to cast General Dempsey as some sort of, you know, wise Yoda here. Not that he's not wise. So he certainly doesn't look like Yoda. But I'm wondering if you read between the lines here, another message is, look, the money we could have spent in Syria to stop this carnage, we already spent in lives, in dollars, and in support of the American people and the armed services, for that matter, in Iraq and Afghanistan. We don't have any room left anymore. Is that a message here?
I think he's saying, look at what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, and don't go in saying this is going to be just a one-shot deal. We'll destroy some Syrian artillery and aircraft and call it a day. That this is going to, if we get involved in a military sense, we are getting involved in a war. And as we saw in the wars after 9/11, they can take a long time to resolve. So I think he believes the military could do it if ordered to, but he wants to make sure that the American people and their political representatives understand what's at stake if they decide to go down that road.
In your reading of history, looks too much like Lebanon to get involved for the Pentagon at this juncture?
You know, my reading is that there is very little pragmatic secular opposition to support. And I really don't know, I don't think anyone really knows enough about the opposition to say there's enough of them that we can arm, train, equip, and then support with perhaps air power and creating a buffer zone in the north and south. If that's possible, We may be able to make a go of it against Bashar al-Assad, his forces, their Russian and Iranian supporters, and, of course, Hezbollah. But you're also going to have to, at the same time, fight the other part of the opposition that is jihadist in character and is extremist. And you certainly don't want to empower them and allow them to create a safe haven in a portion of Syria. So you're going to have to find a secular, pragmatic part of the opposition and make it powerful enough to fight two enemies. It's very, very difficult.
Peter Mansour is professor of military history at Ohio State University. He previously served as executive officer to General David Petraeus from 2007 to 2008. Peter Mansour, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
And now we interrupt our regular programming to report on the latest tear in the fabric of reality. Yes, it was a good day for the British royals. The arrival of the new royal baby, little Mr. Third in Line, the first heir in this century, in this era of Twitter and Facebook. The Duchess of Cambridge delivered of a son, says the royal palace, at 4:24 p.m. local time. 4:24, new lucky number. 8 pounds and 6, the royal weight, takes its place among the lucky numbers. Gain it, lose it, it's good luck, folks. Along with the number 220713, the date. And amidst the imagined cries and moans of the delivering mom, Kate Middleton does not moan or cry. She's perfect. Hey, she produces little kings, the only woman on earth with the power to make the late Princess Diana a grandmum.
On this day, the 22nd of July, the firstborn of His Royal Highness, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge.
There's a tweet-like announcement of a town crier in a kilt outside of the hospital in London. The barely audible 3D postings of another era. But amidst all this, there was a pace of tweets on the royal birth for people who thought they had something to say or who just couldn't contain themselves and latched their wit onto the hashtag RoyalBaby. There was the news, a long-winded Daily Beast. Kate has safely delivered a son at 4:24 p.m. The baby weighs 8 pounds and 6 ounces. The more succinct Guardian, it's a boy, 8 pounds and 6 ounces, born at 4:24 p.m. The more informative Comedy Central 2 minutes later, the royal baby was born weighing 8 pounds or $5 U.S. Hey, dudes, that's more than 12 bucks U.S. Then the commentary. This royal baby is the chosen one. He will bring balance to the Force, says someone claiming to be Darth Vader. The clever actress Ellen Page, whose screen teen pregnancy preceded Kate Middleton's in the movie Juno, couldn't resist. Whoa, people seem super excited for this new British band, the royal baby.
I'm sorry, and if it is any consolation, I have heartburn that is radiating to my kneecaps.
There was some royal bodily humor. How can you tell when there's about to be a royal baby? When they start crowning, says Ellen DeGeneres. Ooh, not since Moses parted the sea has broken water attracted so much attention. Some random fellow. My two favorite tweets, though. Comedian Rob Delaney says, "My life has been a caravan of pain and fear for decades, but the royal baby will turn it all around." And the slightly more earnest from our colleagues at Marketplace, Prince William will be the first member of the British royal family to take official paternity leave. A prince on paternity leave. What would that mean? Got to talk to my good friend Bob Garfield about this. Garfield, of course, is the host of On the Media, produced by Takeaway co-producer WNYC. Bob Garfield, welcome to The Takeaway.
Sorry, I'm still a little emotional.
Yes, of course you are. This is one of those events that you love to talk about. It's a live event. It's not sports. It's not an award show. But it's something that kind of pulls all of the media platforms together for one shining, I guess in your case, emotional moment. Assess it for
it
us.
It certainly does. Well, you forgot one other thing. It doesn't matter.
Right.
It does. You know, Prince Justin, or whatever his name is going to be, will have no bearing on anything to do with the UK, much less any other institution in the world, because he's, it's a ceremonial gig, and all he is ever going to do in his life is he'll play for a while, then he'll smile and he'll wave, and, you know, that's pretty much it. And yet, the world's media organizations have spent untold tens of millions of dollars to follow every bit of his gestation and now his so far short life.
Bob Garfield, host of WNYC's On the Media. Thanks so much, Bob.
My pleasure, John.
Netflix likes to do things its own way. Networks can't support the show Arrested Development. Hearing the theme there. We'll do it. Roll out a series one episode at a time? Forget that. That's not how Washington, D.C. works.
I need somebody I can talk to.
We're talking.
I protect your identity. I print whatever you tell me, and I'll never ask any questions.
And what makes you think I don't already have such an arrangement with one of your colleagues?
Because if you did, you wouldn't have let me through the door.
Emmy-nominated Washington drama House of Cards there from Netflix. In a few minutes, we'll talk about their other hit show, Orange is the New Black. In the market and in the TV audience, Netflix is hot. It's the best-performing U.S. stock in the Standard & Poor's Index for this year, the second most expensive in the S&P. The company announced yesterday it earned $29.5 million, or 29 cents a share, up from $6 million, or 11 cents, last year, with revenue over $1 billion. That's back from the dead for Netflix, but a little less than what traders were expecting, sending shares down about 6% yesterday. Here with us, Laura Hudson, culture and entertainment editor for Wired Magazine. Laura, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, Netflix really is an unbelievable turnaround story, even though the market didn't love the number completely yesterday, right?
All right. I mean, you know, back in 2011, they lost about 800,000 subscribers after a price hike from $10 to $16 a month. But the launch of this new original streaming content in February, starting with House of Cards, has really created some amazing buzz, but also a potentially disruptive technology that's sort of changing the way that people are consuming television or video content, if you want to think about it that way.
If everybody adopts the Netflix model, does this sort of stock surge go away and Netflix becomes the Netscape of sort of on-demand television?
Well, you know, I think that's a good question, and people do talk a lot about the potential for cord cutting. What is this going to mean for traditional television? You know, and I think that I don't know that traditional television is set to go away anytime in the near future, but I do think that Netflix is changing expectations about this type of content, not just whether or not you watch it on the television, but when you watch it. Consider the way that TiVo and DVR has changed the way that people approach TV. You didn't have to tune in at 8 p.m. on a certain night to watch a particular show. You could record it and watch it anytime you wanted. With the Netflix model, where they're actually releasing an entire season of a television show at the same time, this time shifts not just a single episode, but a whole season of a television show, and that's very different.
And you can surround yourself with a whole TV environment now by picking and choosing your own programming and even your own devices. I mean, what TiVo used to do in a refrigerator-sized box can be done in half of a chip inside of a smartphone at this point. We're talking with Laura Hudson, culture and entertainment editor for Wired Magazine. I heard you say a moment ago, cord cutting. Is that terminology they use in the industry for what's about to happen to the networks?
Yeah, it's a term that sort of refers to, you know, are people going to cut the cord with television as we've traditionally understood it in the future? Because a lot of people do consume television exclusively through their computers. I personally don't watch television on television for the most part. I watch it on my computer, on my laptop, and there have been many times in the last couple of years I felt I hadn't needed a cable subscription. So, you know, what does that mean potentially for a lot of these shows or for a lot of these channels?
In market terms, as the price of Netflix stock goes up, does the price of Time Warner and Comcast go down?
That's obviously for the fear for them and the hope for Netflix. You know, but I think that for consumers, the most exciting thing about this is the creative possibilities that the format is going to offer, both for what they can consume and for the way that creators can make shows in completely new ways. And so that's a very exciting thing to see in the market.
Are you a fan of Orange is the New Black?
I'm a huge fan of it. It shows us a lot of faces and voices we aren't used to seeing, not just in terms of women, but women of color, transgender women of color, and women who don't necessarily resemble the very narrow ideals of beauty we typically see in media. And that's something that's possible on Netflix, and I think a way that often isn't on network television or, you know, even channels like HBO and AMC, because, you know, they don't live and die by, you know, how well the ratings on the third episode do.
Right.
There isn't any pressure. They get to have the full season and let that standard fall on it. So.
Laura Hudson, culture and entertainment editor for Wired Magazine on Netflix. Thanks, Laura. Netflix loves to push the envelope in television in more than just the business model.
If I don't get my medication, I'm going through withdrawal. Hot flashes, night sweats, my face will sag, my body hair will start to grow back.
Okay, we don't need to get into
it. Let me explain this for you. I don't have any testosterone left to replace the estrogen that you've taken away from me.
What do you want from me?
I want to see a doctor.
That's Laverne Cox, the transgender actress playing a transgender inmate, Sophia Bursette, on the series Orange is the New Black. The series follows blonde-haired, blue-eyed Piper Chapman, a college graduate who ends up involved in a drug ring and 10 years later gets caught and sentenced to prison, where she meets Sophia.
She's talking to the devil.
Yeah, I got that part.
That's Satan's doll.
At least Satan gets a door.
Give it a week. You'll be pissing and fighting with the rest of us.
Actress Laverne Cox is thrilled to be in the fight on what looks like a hit series, and she is well aware that her performance in a leading role and the show's success represents a breakthrough in entertainment and possibly in American culture.
For me, as an actress and as an artist, I've always been really interested in telling human stories and having characters that are multidimensional and people who we might not necessarily be programmed to empathize with in real life. And I think this show exemplifies that. Lots of women's stories that we don't get to see and hear a lot. Women of different races, ages, body types. I think it's a real depiction of one aspect of the American landscape, which is really important.
In the prison where the whites hang out is called the suburbs. So.
And where the blacks are is the ghetto.
Yeah.
It's funny, and I love that we're able to, and Gingy, our creator, talks a lot in her interviews about using humor to deal with some very intense and traumatizing situations. And I love the balance of humor with the intense drama in our show. Reading the scripts, I would sort of be laughing out loud to myself, and then I would just start burst out crying.
There's a real sense of contrast in characters who are fundamentally benign, like the nun. Or the yoga hippie woman. Is this about narratives of individual women who've all made one mistake, and that explains why they're there, and that we're looking at that one mistake and how it plays out in prison?
I don't think so. I don't think it's one mistake. I think everyone makes mistakes. I think some people just get caught and some people don't, and there's different consequences for certain people. I think that our show explores so brilliantly how the consequences for Piper, because she is white and blonde and beautiful, might be different for someone who is not that. And I think that reflects the real world. I was talking to a dear friend of mine last night about Wall Street and how some of the activity that happened on Wall Street during the economic downturn were pretty criminal. And those guys no one's really been prosecuted.
Well, there's a sense among the characters that they're struggling with I'm not really this. You're looking at me thinking I'm this, but I'm actually this. There's a real struggle with identity. Piper, for instance, is, I'm nice. I just made this one mistake 10 years ago. Or the woman, Cook, who's such a fascinating character, Red. I mean, she's,
The brilliant Kate Mulgrew.
Brilliant, yeah. And everyone wants you to think there's some way, but ultimately we can't control the way people think about us.
Well, I think in real life, there's always a disparity between how people often, not always, often a disparity between how we're perceived and who we really are in an authentic way. As a trans person, I often think about what it means to be authentic. And so much of being trans is about making the person you are on the inside match who the world sees on the outside. I believe that there is a universal humanity that we all have, that we all sort of ultimately want the same things. We want to be loved and accepted. And those elements are important to bring to every character. For me as an artist, it's important for me to get in touch with my own sense of wanting to be loved and accepted and wanting to have connection and bring that to Sophia and whatever character I play.
There's a moment in the third episode where there is a playing of you as a man, the fireman character
yes.
who essentially begins the story of how you ended up in prison. How did you feel about that?
In episode two, this is the amazing set that I was working on, Gingy, came to me and when we were shooting episode 2, and she said, "We're looking to hire someone to play you pre-transition, to play Sophia as the firefighter." And I was like, who are you going to hire? I have to play it. Because, we actors think we can, play anything. And then they started bringing in these guys, really sort of butch, guys, and photographing me next to them, and they looked nothing like me. And then they decided to do an audition, and my agent told our casting director, "Well, Laverne has a twin brother," and Jen Oosten, our brilliant casting director, was like, I have to see him, and he auditioned, and he got the part.
In many ways, the trans experience is unusual enough that it's not like people are going to go, that wasn't real. Oh, that was real. They're going to accept almost anything you say about sexuality as absolutely real. Maybe the trans community will, write you some emails or something like that. But is it realism?
The piece that you just said that, like, we'll almost accept anything because we don't know is such an important piece, I think. It's such an important thing to point out, because so often trans stories have been told in ways that sensationalize our identities, that objectify our bodies and sort of focus on transition and don't really have the human piece, or the takeaway becomes all about surgery. What's exciting to me is that there's a lot of realism in terms of the real life lived experiences of trans people. A lot of trans folks are being denied hormones in prison, for example.
And that happens in this episode.
That happens in episode 3. And that's that real women like Sophia are dealing with that in prison right now. Real women are dealing with all levels of violence in prison. And really the response to Sophia and the response from the audience to the show, in a lot of ways, says it all. I feel like the public has been yearning and not honestly desperate, but like really wanting to have a show that they feel reflects them. I mean, specifically the trans folks who've written me have been so excited about Sophia and excited to see this character that's a little bit like them, that they can relate to in this sort of mainstream media context. And it's so important for folks to see folks who look like them and reflect their experiences, because it's validating. And when folks can look at the TV and say, "This person knows what I've been through," it validates their experience. Mm. And it's a really powerful thing.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
That's great. And do we know about a second season?
We have been renewed for season 2. Yes. Absolutely. We were renewed before we even premiered, which is very exciting.
That's very exciting. Congratulations again. Laverne Cox, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Laverne Cox plays Sophia Bursette, a leading character on the new Netflix original series, Orange is the New Black. She is transgender, as is her character on the show.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
All this week, we're exploring the experience of being a caregiver to a loved one. Roughly 66 million Americans working every day on call for someone.
Hi, my name is Jeff. I'm calling from Charlotte, North Carolina. I had to care for my wife and my mother, who simultaneously were sick. My wife was injured in a car accident, critically injured. A week later, my mother was diagnosed with cancer. And now I'm seeking treatment for PTSD, of all things.
We don't recognize these workers in America. There are no organized benefits for them, even though their lives have changed so dramatically. Professor Margaret Batten was catapulted into a radically new experience of life when she became the caregiver for her husband, Brooke. He went from being an active, healthy spouse to being a completely dependent, severe quadriplegic after a bicycle accident that nearly killed him. That was back in November of 2008. The experience is sinking in for Peggy and Brooke in ways that have surprised even them. Peggy is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the University of Utah and has spent the greater part of her life advocating for patients' rights to end their lives. Peggy allowed us into her world of caregiving and her new routine of valuing life every day amidst all of the nurses and constant machines keeping her husband alive. In her case, when the end of life is a matter of simply flicking a switch, one learns deeply to understand that mysterious place between life and death.
Respirators, machines, feeding tubes. Brooke has all those things. He has a feeding tube now. He has a cardiac pacer. He has a diaphragmatic pacer, which stimulates breathing. He has a ventilator, at least some of the time. He requires supplementary oxygen some of the time. He requires many medications. Those are all things that might have been, rejected, or if a living will had been honored. But you know what? He has said, you can get used to anything, right? Those things, when he doesn't feel well, those things loom large. But when he does feel well, those things are just part of the way he is present in the world. They make him work, but they're not the focus of his attention.
So many of the caregivers we've spoken with describe the experience as isolating sometimes, as a responsibility that is overwhelming. From your perspective, whose responsibility is the maintenance of Brooke's life? Is that his? Is that yours? Is that society's? Who does that hang on?
It seems to me caregiving at its best is a two-way street. The caregiver provides care for the patient, but the patient also cares about the caregiver. But I don't think of his care as entirely my doing. In fact, the first thing that I thought about when he was injured, or you try to think about what this will be like, is to make sure that I never thought of myself as the sole or only caregiver or tried to do it all myself. That means burnout, collapse, and you don't want a person with needs as substantial as Brooks to be entirely dependent on a single person. After all, something could happen to me too. And there are other things too. So you try to think about what you need and want that will make voluntary caregiving, elective caregiving, caregiving you want to do, not that you have to do, possible. So for one thing, exercise has always seemed important to me. Got to keep exercising so you don't fall apart physically. Work. Work is a very large part of my identity, I guess you'd say. So you can't give up something that's that central and be a care provider without resentment.
I'm wondering if you could talk about how at one moment Brooke decided to refuse care and how that ended up affirming this whole caregiving enterprise that you've been involved with for now the last 2 years.
Happened one afternoon. It happened to be April Fool's Day, just by coincidence. It was a gray sort of late winter day. Spring just wasn't there, though it should have been. And Brooke had been saying that he wanted to die, that he wanted everything unplugged. And remember that person has the legal right to discontinue therapy that is keeping them alive. I was there with a respiratory therapist, one we are very fond of, trust deeply. And we happened to be sitting there with Brooke in the living room, and he said, I want to die. I want you to unplug everything right now. So we did. We unplugged the ventilator, took it off. We discontinued the supplementary oxygen, and his diaphragmatic pacer has an external battery pack that you can turn on and off. So we turned it off too and showed him that we had turned it off. So those three things were all deactivated. It was a very compelling moment. He sat in his chair in the living room, one of us on either side of him. And he sat as upright as he could manage, with his eyes closed. There didn't seem to be tears or agitation or anything. He appeared to be completely calm. And he sat there, and he sat there, and he sat there. And then after about 2 or 3 minutes that were among the longest minutes you can imagine, He opened his eyes. And he said, am I alive? Am I alive? I'm supposed to be dead, right? And it took quite a while to convince him that he was really alive. Am I dreaming, he asked. No, you're not dreaming. you're really alive. And his sense of disbelief, I couldn't be alive. Everything was unplugged. As that dissipated and he realized that he really was alive, he said, I'm so overjoyed. I'm so happy. He said he would never use a phrase like this normally, but he would. He said, I'm a particularly happy camper. Right. So the respiratory therapist and I had known that he wouldn't die. At least we had believed that. But just the same, it taught us something about the relationship between the expression of a wish to die and what happened in this case when someone discovered that he was still alive and was so happy. But you can't generalize that either to other people in other situations or beyond this particular instance just for Brooke. So what if he had discovered he was still alive and been angry, disappointed, maybe furious?
What would you have done?
I don't know.
I guess I'm astounded in this narrow-seeming space between whether you have a ventilator on or have a battery pack connected or not, and death, that you've managed to find such sort of dignity and pride in being independent, to being Brooke amidst all that machinery, and that that's some lesson about life.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think you can say that. We both try at this. We try to keep it from being a tragedy. We try to keep from thinking of it as a tragedy. We try to focus on those things that are really important. Walking isn't really important. It's convenient. But as you well know, one can have a full and rich life without walking. I think that's a good definition for caregiving. That is, recognizing that there are other ways to be in the world.
Margaret Peggy Batten is Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of Utah and caregiver to her husband, Brooke, Professor of English at the University of Utah. Thanks, Peggy.
Thanks.
Peggy and Brooke's story was recently profiled by our partner, The New York Times. Our caregiver series continues all this week. Tweet us your stories using the hashtag #ICareFor. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.